Ladies and gentlemen, dear participants, it's time to start. And I have the pleasure to invite our guests here today to this roundtable discussion. And I think we all have the pleasure to listen to their professional views on today's topic, which is the value and relevance of political and sociological educational research. And this session is combining themes and topics discussed over the 2 days, yesterday and today, during two different events which have been coordinated in collaboration. And we've had an educational research colloquium that is a new tradition at this Faculty of Education and the Institute of Finnish Institute for Educational Research, and also the master's degree program of educational research, political and sociological educational research, organized by the University of Helsinki, Turku and Jyväskylä in collaboration since 2012. And this session here, this roundtable now, will discuss issues: what is the value and what is the relevance of this type of research, combining political, sociological, educational research and governance issues. And I would like to first introduce our participants, introduce very briefly. We have Professor Elaine Unterhalter from the University of London, Institute of Education, which is one of the partner universities and institutions of our university. And Elaine Unterhalter is an expert in especially looking at issues on development, development politics and development education, and global issues related to equality. And then we have Professor Marit Alasuutari. And Marit Alasuutari is a professor in education and a specialist in early childhood education, and is leading an important new research project in equality in early childhood and early childhood education. And we have then Professor Risto Rinne, who is an educational sociologist from Turku, well known here in Finland and internationally, and has been running this kind of political and sociological educational research projects for decades. And then we have Dr. Ritva Reinikka, who's been working over 20 years at the World Bank, and been one of the directors and developed, for instance, approaches how to use research when it comes to political issues, global development, and also social development. And then we have Professor Hannu Simola from the University of Helsinki, who is also an educational sociologist and has also discussed these issues of international collaboration and international organizations in his research and teaching. And I would like to welcome you all to this roundtable. And we are very pleased to have you here today. I'm glad that you busy people had time, you busy professionals had time to join us for this discussion. And I have requested you to have a very brief introduction to the topic from your professional point of view. And I would like to invite Professor Elaine Unterhalter to start.
Thanks, Selina, and very nice to be here and amazing to be in this most beautiful building. I want to start my response to this question, the value and relevance of political and sociological education, by doing what I ask my students to do, which is answer the autobiography of the question. And the autobiography of my answer to the question is that I'm a South African, and addressing and thinking about inequalities is very deep in my cultural experience. It's been woven through a lot of my professional life and a lot of the friendships that have been part of that's driven that professional life. By training, I'm a historian, and I'm part of that generation of South African historians that started to challenge the kind of history we were taught at school, which was a kind of liberal defense of colonialism in South Africa. And so this a process of thinking about history from the bottom was where I got my academic training. And thinking of history from the bottom puts political and social issues very central to the frame of what history is about. But I moved into education because of two experiences. My first experience, work experience, was working at a mission hospital in a very rural area of South Africa. And I had come from a highly segregated society, a very suburban, white experience, and suddenly I was in this experience where I knew nothing. I couldn't speak the language. I thought I had a university degree and I had something to offer, and I was reliant on the kindness of people who taught me. So the kind of learning-teaching relationships were completely inverted, and it was a space I started to learn from. And the other space I started to learn from about politics and the value of political and social dynamics in education was I spent about 20 years working in the ANC in exile in the education department. And again, I was amongst a group of people who were so different from so many different backgrounds. Thinking about politics, thinking about social issues, that was what we did. That was our default position. That was written into the DNA of what we're doing. For a long time, I think I thought those experiences were, what was profound about them was the confrontation of difference, so that the value of political and sociological educational experiences is mixing people up. But I think I'm starting to understand is that these were rather protected spaces. They were spaces in which people were allowed to express ideas, to push against the boundaries. And so the short part of my answer to what's the value of political and sociological approaches to education is that it gives you the support to look at what was, what is, and what you think ought to be, and gives you the space to explore those questions. And you need that dynamic of the three together.
Thank you. Can we move on to Professor Marit Alasuutari?
Okay, I started to think about this question political and sociological educational research in early childhood education or related to early childhood education from a fairly different perspective, and partly because our discipline, early childhood education, and I'm now going to talk about it in a very kind of narrow perspective, just about the research and work that is done in this field. It's a newcomer, still a newcomer in the academia. We have been a university discipline for about 20 years, and compared to, for example, to sociology, it's very different, this history. And in this 20 years, early childhood education has changed from a primarily vocation-oriented training program to a discipline, academic discipline, that has particular research fields and that provides research-based academic education. But for several reasons, early childhood education in Finland, as in many other countries, has deep roots in psychology. And this is shown, for example, in studies about pedagogy and educators' professional development and identity, which are of interest for many scholars in our field, in our country. But the other side of the coin is then that this political or sociological research on early childhood education in Finland is fairly rare, or there isn't as much of that. And here in Jyväskylä, there's one major exception, I would say. We are very strong in sociology of childhood, research on sociology of childhood. But if you think about sociology in general, this is a very marginal field too. If you look at the main handbooks of sociology, for example, you hardly find any notion or mentioning about sociology of childhood. But then, of course, there is also research, for example, related or about professionalism in early childhood education that often draws on sociological literature and research and studies about the organization of the institution. But then when we think about this other field, this political research in early childhood education, I would say that there's even less of that than sociological research. It's almost non-existent. Some research has been carried out in social policy, but not that much either in that discipline. After early childhood education as a service and a provision got kind of or established its position in Finnish society and then especially not much after early childhood education became an academic discipline. But now recent developments and changes in our society have in a way shown us that we are missing knowledge in this area, and there's a new interest in studying, for example, policies and steering of early childhood education. Of course, then internationally, the picture is somewhat different. There's more research in the policies and in the from the perspective of sociology, and there are also major global actors in the field, especially the OECD. And partly due to the Starting Strong project of the OECD, the discussion and research on curriculum development and implementation, and also there are now this relates to the concept of lifelong learning, but this type of research has been really lively in the international literature. And then, of course, provision, accessibility of the services, and these relate to such topics as minorities, diversity, and equality. They interest international scholars as well as research of professionalization. And we find also literature, a kind of critical literature on discourses such as the investment discourse. But what is evident is also the fact that most of the research comes from the global north. So, and very much the research is contextual, or the context of the research are the national societies. So there's fairly little international comparisons. And although there is more research coming from, for example, African and Asian countries, and more research published from these contexts, still the Western societies is the most common scene of the discussions.
Thank you. And now, Professor Ristorinne.
Well, I'm an old man. About as old as Hannu Simola. But I made my dissertation in 1984, and I have been working already before that in the field of sociology of education in Finland, which was quite rare at that time. And we put forward this institute, which was research unit for the sociology of education. And it was some kind of companion with Department of Education and Department of Sociology and Political Research. So for the first beginning, we try to combine these two fields. And during that research, it began with a report and a research affair of the historical, the socio-historical formation of a Finnish basic education. And it was published something there in 1985 or 6 or something like that, where we tried to make very, very strong connections to the European and also international discussions about why the school is as it is. Why this school as a place for educating people, but also doing a lot of other things to the people, integrating people, classifying the people, selecting the people, and storing the people. We made a strong emphasis to research this thing. When I made some 15 years work together with research unit for the sociology of education, and after that I moved I forced first in Tampere. I came from Turku University to Tampere University. In Turku I was a professor in sociology of education. I moved to Tampere. I was professor of educational politics. And then I moved back to Turku. And then we grounded a new research unit, which is SELE. It is a Center for Research on Lifelong Learning and Education. And there is now some 50 people working there, and they are all devoted to research the sociology of education and politics of education. But for the last times, we have very much devoted to the comparative education. We want to see how the world is laying, not only in Finland, but also all over the world. What is happening everywhere. And at the moment, in 2016, my unit is one of, I could say anyhow, but it is one of the most comparative-oriented research units in Finland, in sociology of education. And this is the work we have done, I have done, and I think that we have some 5 research projects funded by European Union, funded by Finnish Academy, funded by different kinds of places. And we have 5 research groups. One is comparative education, one is higher education, one is lifelong learning and labor market, one is special education and immigrant people, and one is something I don't remember. So 5 research groups, and at the moment I think they work quite well. But at that time, in 1980s, when we began this work, it was very, very difficult to see the worth of sociology of education and politics of education to be researched. Because this field of education is mostly occupied by people from didactics before, not anymore perhaps, and psychology of education. So this more social views of what is happening in the world, we are forgotten. So that's me.
And Dr. Ritva Reinikka.
Thank you very much, Elina, and thank you everyone for being here. So what I will do, I'm a practitioner, and my perspective is development economics. So I'm an economist in this group, but I have done a lot of operational work as well as research in education. And so, but my viewpoint is really focuses perhaps the value and relevance of educational research. Political and sociological is less of my field. So you will have a little different take. Also, my perspective is middle-income and low-income countries. That's where I have worked all my professional life, really. And the research that I have carried out has been in the areas of public spending, educational systems, service delivery, and governance. So those are the research areas. But really, during the time I spent the 20 years in the World Bank, my always goal was to use research to make the action more informed and better and have more impact. And just in the context of education, I want to give you an example of what this type of research is and how it is used. Just a brief example. And the key message of this example is that there is a learning crisis in many low-income and middle-income countries. And I don't know, are you, Marianne, doing my slides? So just put the first slide. I'm just showing you graphs. We are not going to go in there. But there are all types of learning outcome tests. You know them better than I do, probably. The slide uses TIMSS 2011, which is testing 8th graders on math. And you see all those, you see there South Korea and Finland on the left-hand side, at the top bars. Not much red there. But when you go to the countries, you see all that red. Those are the 8th graders who have basically learned nothing from math. And my practitioner feel is that you should not put kids to school for 8 years if they don't learn. The learning is really important. But there are, in the African context where I worked a lot, there are many other tests than TIMSS. There is SACMEC, there is PASEC in the Francophone Africa. They all show really not good outcomes at all. And so the NGOs do that type of work and so forth. So in that context, the example I wanted to give you comes from an activity that is called Service Delivery Indicators. And I want to highlight that. It's a collaborative work with the African Economic Research Consortium, and which covers the whole continent, which tries to explain in certain ways and also address to make a change in this learning crisis. So far, this service delivery indicators has been implemented in 10 countries covering about 350 million people because they are representative surveys of schools, primary schools. So what does this, I'm just giving you a highlight, just a few things. What does this big data effort do? So it focuses on the teacher. It basically asks, what does the teacher know and what does the teacher do? Based on heavily observational type of work, it asks questions like, how much time do teachers actually spend teaching? Do teachers have the relevant knowledge to teach both lower order and higher order language and math skills? So these are math teachers and language teachers. And then it asks also, do teachers have the pedagogical knowledge and skills to transfer what they know to students in an effective way? And we spent several years in this collaborative effort with educators like you guys to design the tests, design the observational modules in such a way that you get relevant information. And the picture from this is not very pretty, and I think it should change very, very fast. For instance, averaging across countries, these countries that have been included mostly in Africa, we find that students receive about 2.5 hours of teaching a day, which is less than half of the scheduled time in the countries. And it's largely because teachers, even if when they are in school, they do not teach. The other disconcerting finding is that only 1 in 10 fourth grade teachers master their student curriculum, the curriculum they teach. And also a quarter of the teachers fail simple tasks such as subtracting two-digit numbers or choosing the correct pronoun to complete the sentence. So there are also pedagogical tests in this, And the data sets, if any of you is particularly in sociological research, perhaps more than political research, you use a lot of data. So the data sets are very vast. They also include testing of students so that you can link, does it matter if the teacher doesn't know the content? But basically in many of these countries, the education systems have expanded so massively that almost anybody has been able to become a teacher. So given these findings, and I just gave you a highlight to give you a flavor, I hope I succeeded in giving you a flavor on what this type of work entails. So it's really not surprising that pupils do not learn, and particularly in the African context where the continent's population will double in the next 30-35 years, most young people going to the labor market will have to employ themselves. They don't have the choice of going to somebody else's employment unless they have secondary education or beyond. So we talk about 10-20% can work elsewhere. So when you are in operational, practical work, for me, it would be really important to change the situation in the schools so that these students this is the only skills training they are going to have, and if they leave the school without knowing how to read and write properly and count and numeracy and so forth, it's really a big problem. So this is a major policy issue. It's also a major research issue in the sense that in my area, which is development economics, because of identifying causal effects, people have really gone to randomized controlled trials because there you can do that. But those are small interventions and you never look at the system. So it's really important. These systems need changing about one or two standard deviation in learning outcomes. It's a massive change that is needed. But then I want to close just this example with a more positive note. And Marianne, if you can put the second slide, you don't have to look at any of the detail necessarily of the slide, but I wanted to just demonstrate with this, it's on Tanzania, that a research like this can really have an impact. So what happened in Tanzania, the Ministry of Education, led by the minister, so there was the political will in that case, took the 2010 survey, we call them SDI surveys, he took that very seriously. And the whole, Tanzania has just now changed government, but the whole that time, until the second survey 2014, they worked on improving these things. So you see every bar going up there. For instance, Tanzanian students in urban schools were getting only 1 hour, 24 minutes a day teaching. It has now doubled. That did not cost anything more. It just was a change in behavior. So in a way, it's not all about money. It's really about the systems, the incentives. The teachers are intrinsically motivated types, usually. The question is, why do they sink in a system that makes them not to come to work, not to teach, and so forth? So this is really just to, but on the positive note, these are not very positive things to deal with, but they have to be dealt with. And then there can be a change quite fast when the conditions are right. Thank you.
Thank you. And Professor Hannu Simola.
Thank you, and thank you, all of you, giving your presentation before me, and especially after Ritva, it is easy to speak because you very strongly spoke about issue which I think it's crucial here. All of you know that the world is complex, and the life is even more complex. And especially because of that, I am really fond of so-called KISS principle. How many of you knows what is KISS principle? Mm-hmm. Not very many. So keep it simple, stupid. So this means that just because the world is so complex, it is important to try to keep it simple. Because without that, we can't act, actually. If we just think that it's so fluent and complex, so we can just give up. And so I warn you that my words will be very simplified, so you shouldn't take them too seriously. But I start with the eminent founding father of sociology of education, or not very founding because he's still living, but the Stanford professor, John W. Meyer, who metaphorically said that mass education is a religious base of modern society. And just later he also said that the master education is a religious base of post or late modern society. This means that, you know, there is in Kazakhstan now master students more than in whole world in 1900. So there's no relation to any needs, but it's a kind of religious base of late modern society. And starting from that simple point, it's quite easy to see the problems of education from my point of view, or that we are much more interested and focused on ideas, ideologies, innovations, best practices or whatsoever than how to implement them into the reality, to the real life of education. There is a 150 years of history of frustrations in schooling to change the school. And that's why, from my point of view, sociology and politics of education is about the context, the reality of the education. I'm not saying that psychology and didactics are not necessary. They are absolutely necessary. But what I mean that you may find great ideas, great goals, as we, for example, Education for All and all this long list of UNESCO and United Nations, we all agree of those goals. That's one thing, no problem. But how to get them working in the reality? And I'm not now speaking about development countries or something like that, but Finland too. Because it's the same thing. It was funny when Ritva was referring to the classroom studies in Tanzania or in some other countries. In Finland, there is very little classroom study, actually. There are studies where the researchers are talking with teachers and asking what they are doing there. But to go to the classrooms and check what they really are doing is another thing. There's a classical research from Sweden comparing the child-centered and the subject-centered education in the classroom practices. They measured teachers who said that they are subject-centered and those who said that they are pupil, student-centered. And they didn't find any difference. They did the absolutely same thing in the reality of a classroom. Now, finally, they found one difference. The teachers who said that they are student-centered, pupil-centered, child-centered, they took more steps in the classroom. That was the only difference. So what I'm saying that we have very strong tradition to create wonderful, brilliant, sexy goals for education, aims, objects, and so on. But we have much less studies about the context, the reality, where they should be implemented. And that is the main thing which I think that where the sociology of education and political studies are needed and vital. The political side of this is more the studies of agency. Those who act really there, and agents, teachers, parents, kids, because we have also a very strong tradition as in religion, in the top-down movement. When they are always there in the heaven or in the church, there is a truth. There is a faith, correct faith there, and its problem is how to get it into there. That's the way how this kind of missionary thinking of education is taken, rather than going to the field and seeing what really happens there and how the real people there in the classroom
are like. We are friends.
Yes, of course. That's what I mean. And as a research subject, I call it my research group is we are especially studying what we call dynamics in education politics. So dynamics means how this all big mess moves, how it differently life lives in different contexts, different countries, different areas. So that's what we call dynamics in education politics. And education politics means, of course, in the different, until the micro level, there in the families, the parents are doing politics there, making decisions and choosing something, up to the Minister of Education and all these things. So context and the agency. Thank you.
Thank you. What I would like to know also is that because we are now educating maybe children, young people, adults, and teachers, teacher educators today, but the changes are very rapid in today's society, globally, locally, and they are more connected than ever before. What are the key tasks now? If you think we are to, you know, educate people for the future, what do you think are the key tasks of political and sociological educational research? You partly responded to that already in your introductions. Would you like to very sort of briefly highlight what do you think are the key tasks now for the future? Changes are rapid and sometimes unprecedented. We can't really foresee what's going to happen tomorrow, but we are educating today, and our expectation is that our so-called target groups will have the agency for the future.
Do you want me to start? Central to everything I want to say are concerns with inequalities, but I think that the tasks we have to do are actually some of the tasks many of us have recapped in different ways. And I've got three verbs. I think it's important to teach students to dig into the conceptual meanings. It's important to teach students to build across disciplines, to build across practice, to build between theory and practice, to build between contexts, and to use a whole range of different knowledge frames. And it's very important to teach students to bridge between where they've come, where they're going, our times, different people. So those processes of histories, conceptual critique, finding a voice, listening to others' voices, going below the surface, speaking in multiple languages. I think with that in your, none of us know the future. It scares us, I think. But, we can't foolproof against it. We can only go sort of with an open heart and a mind that's receptive.
Building bridges, in brief.
But not forgetting the digging, not forgetting the history of where we've come from. Digging, building, and bridging.
Digging, building, and bridging. Thank you. And Marit.
Okay, when I think about the key tasks of political and sociological educational research, that was the question, and early childhood education, then I think we have to remember that or kind of keep in mind that early childhood education as a field is somewhat different from other fields of education. It studies educates professionals to a field which is and to a practice which is not an obligatory one, or usually not an obligatory one. And like in international discussions, we often talk about early childhood education and care. There's this aspect included. And so the field, it's linked with many policies, family policies, gender policies, labor markets, of course other fields of education, but in a different way. And I think when I take this domestic perspective now, Finnish perspective, I think that one of our tasks is to kind of go back and also consider whether we are talking about the implementation of specific practices and why specific practices or developments are important. We need to be aware of the context now, recently, Finland got a new legislation on early childhood education and care. And, for example, in the preparation of this legislation, it became very clear that we have good research. We have research from the kind of the microspace of education. But then, okay, we can say that, you know, this is important, but we get the counter arguments, but you know, there's this context, and we miss knowledge about that. And I think that's something we need to work on. So that's one point at least.
And you mean context, really the political and
political
the social context,
and
cultural.
Our linkage and interplay. So the interplay of early childhood education and the other fields of policies and so.
Thank you, Risto.
I have here as our finance minister 3 points for this question. The first is that in this cruel, unequalizing world of us, which has happened all over the world and inside every nation, we have to think what are the possibilities of educational system and education to equalize the world, or even to try to make more and more, can you hear me there? No. Yeah. So I think that this equalizing the education and thinking about the education politics as making the utmost aim to equalize the world, although we are living in this world with cruelty and segmentation and everything bad which is involved. The second point is that I think that it is very important, as I told you already, that we are practicing more and more comparative education research. It is more and more clear that we have to research on the relationships of global, supranational, national, and local education realities. And is there any more national education politics, or is everything under the supranational power of, for example, big firms, OECD, World Bank, and these kinds of things? And the third is that we have at least 3/4 understandings what is happening in the world, written by Roger Dale and Stephen Ball, for example. They are speaking about the isms which are still in our thinking and which are false. One is nationalism. We think that education is nationalism. It is ruled by the nation. That is not true anymore. The other thing is statism. We are thinking that the public state is ruling everything and making the good things. That is not either true. In many countries, as you know, there are private education institutes, there are different kind of things which are coming to that. But statism is not true anymore. And the third is that it is educationalism. We think that education, as we think it, is a solution, and it is ruled by the educational politics. That is not either true, because there are so many agents in the world, so many firms, private things, consults, whatsoever, are making their deal how the educational governance actually is formed. So we come to the theme of governance, how it is done.
Thank you. So the context is broadening there, and with different new layers to think about when it comes to the context and isms. And Ritva?
I thought the isms were dead, but clearly they aren't.
They aren't in the educational research.
Okay, a few points picking on what colleagues have said. I think first, equity or inequality. It is, I don't have an answer to that, but it is that on the one hand, education is an absolutely fantastic equalizer thing. I mean, I'm a product of this Finland's education, grew up in the countryside, skied to school, and I ended up as a director at the World Bank. Why? Because I had a very solid education. So it does equalize. I think here it has equalized. But then when you look at particularly the research that has done in the institution where I have been looking at the technological change, etc., and the income disparities that are created between those who have the strong education and are able to participate and those that don't have it. So that's one. I think you asked what should be taught. When thinking in advance, I thought one should teach critical thinking, open-mindedness. I mean, that kind of skills, but it's interesting because just 2 days ago I was in WHO, World Health Organization, talking about with health professionals, because health is a very similar one. It's a transaction-intensive discretionary service. Lots of people. There are providers who are people. It's not like a well or a road. It's a very different service. But they were absolutely into the future. They were describing that actually, you know, you don't need an eye doctor to smartphone and send the picture and get the diagnosis. You can diagnose many of the things yourself. And they were talking a lot about how that will change the health profession completely. I found it very fascinating. I haven't yet heard similar things here yet, but I'm sure you guys are discussing it. Two more points, small points. I wanted to mention on the early childhood education, again, coming from a different non-education background, there was one paper in the cadre of finance ministers and those who do financing that put early childhood education in the map, and that's the Nobel Prize winning Jim Heckman. I mean, that has changed so many minds already, because what it shows is that the investment in early childhood gives the highest return by far. And then already, I was talking about primary education earlier, but that is already a little too late. So even if there is so much to do to improve there, so there can be these types of kind of important pieces that can then go beyond the, like, let's say, education research here, and simply everybody wants to now do early childhood education. And perhaps then I come back to the final point is to say that for me, I feel very strongly, well, even if economists seldom are very strong advocates, I really do feel that primary schooling and the issues I talked earlier, there has to be massive change. Otherwise, there will be huge discrepancies between low and some middle-income countries, not all, but some, and the rich countries, because the education quality issue is becoming so burning. So I wanted to say this last phrase that I do think what needs to be done is we always say learning for all. And in these countries I'm talking about, there needs to be all for learning, because it is such a big thing that needs to be changed. Thank you.
Thank you. So learning for all is very much in line with the recently agreed global sustainable development goal, that it's quality and for all. And now, Hannu Simola.
We've been working for, 20 years with Risto and doing the same researches, but my conclusions are a bit different than Risto's. And I think that from the same studies, I think that it's simply the question of the personality. So I think that Risto is more skeptical pessimist, and I'm skeptical optimist. And my reason why I do not believe in that there is no national, there is no local, there is only transnational or overnational or cross-national or something like that. It's simply CCR. Who knows what is CCR? What's the band called CCR? Creedence Clearwater Revival. But yes. Here it means C, complexity, C, contingency, and R, relationalism. This means that the world is so complex, so contingent, which means that there is, combination of free will and accident. And the relations, everything is in relations. So much that not even the World Bank
and is able to... Especially not the World Bank.
Yes, but... No Obama, no capitalism as such, is able to direct the world or...
No.
So that's much more complex. And so I think that this is I would call it skeptical optimism. So fortunately, the world is so complicated that we do have some chance. But back to the question, what we should do is that we should... My first focus of research is the... reality of classroom everywhere. It's universal in a sense, but it's always also specific. Risto has called it in his early study, so the teachers call it the everyday life in classroom. So they do not conceptualize or articulate it more, because it's everyday life there. You are up here, there, and you just work there. But in research, is it conceptualized by Risto, for example, as a system of time and space and rituals of schooling. Time, space, and rituals of schooling. Some other researchers call about the grammar of schooling. I like very much this grammar of schooling. I call it societal frames of schooling. Societal frames of schooling. And I think that the focus research everywhere, that this is the key for understanding how the bright and brilliant ideas may come true. Because we have, as I said, 150 years of frustrations to trying to do all these things there in the classroom. So there's nothing new in these ideas. Well, of course, digitalization is a different thing, but... And the basic conclusion of education reform could be said that when the school is reformed, something will change, always, but it's rarely what is aimed. Understand? Something changed. It's so complex thing. And so we should go there and see, how does it work? This? What is the dynamics of life there? And then we may ask, because we have 150 years of experience, how difficult it is. School doesn't change easily, and it's the same thing with all other educational fields. In university, we should also ask, what is a hidden curriculum of universities? This is one way. Very rarely asked questions. Okay.
We could ask you also that you discussed classroom as a context, as an important context.
And this situation, for example, where
exactly.
You are now.
You're referring to that. I wanted to refer to this, that we are no longer in the classroom, at least in this building anymore. We have a lot more, sort of other types of spaces. and digitalization, as you mentioned. So classroom may not be the context anymore to do the research.
This is very clear, classroom without, you know, somebody are speaking and some other people are silent there, you know, hours and hours.
But Hannu, we are down, we are up.
And this follows my ideology. I think it should be this way. Mm-hmm. But we can also get questions from the audience. Would you like to ask something?
Yes, indeed.
You mentioned that.
Can you speak a bit closer?
Okay. You mentioned that poverty was a big factor in this discrepancy between educations in the world. But on the graph you showed, there seemed to be a lot of these oil-rich Middle Eastern countries which were doing badly as well in the education system. Is there any kind of explanation for that?
You know, sometimes it's much easier to describe things and look at the learning outcomes, etc. You may not be able to, you need a lot of focus groups, talking with the locals, etc., to really understand what it is. I have, during my work in the bank especially, I worked also in the Middle East and North Africa, and there has been a lot of improvement. It is true, compared to the rich countries. So I guess my main point was that if the quality issue in these countries where the quality is really bad, if it's not addressed decisively, and because I use a lot of statistics, for me when I say standard deviation, one or two standard deviation change, it means radical change. Middle East requires that as well. I think when working there, what I noticed a lot, and which was also reflected in the Arab Spring, not only primary education, these are eighth graders, but also university education, was that there was a lot of university education, but it was divorced from the economic realities. So Hannu is talking about realities in the classroom, as I am also, but there are other realities. So when you went to university, you did studies that didn't give you a job. You were not able to become an entrepreneur or get a job because the economy had a completely different structure from the higher education. So that doesn't exactly answer the question why, but they don't do very well on this type of thing either. But there is, they've expanded overall education massively, but the young people's frustration is like we all always talk about the Tunisian, you know, fruit and vegetable seller who set himself alight and triggered the Arab Spring. He just was an educated guy and that was all he could do because the job market didn't answer. So I gave you a feature of those, as far as I can see, the big picture. But this quality type of thing, so as long as people focus on PISA, it's like one African country that participated in PISA is Mauritius, but they never wanted to publish the results. That's politics. And the results were not good. And yet, they are the best country in Eastern and Southern African SACMEC results. So in a way, it's the perhaps you are emphasizing my earlier point that this issue needs to be tackled, because otherwise the discrepancy just carries on or increases even more. And you are right, it goes well beyond Africa.
Thank you. Anybody else who would like to comment on this question concerning the Middle East, Middle Eastern countries? Yes, Elaine.
I don't know the situation very well, and there might be people in the audience who know, but what I understand is that the systems of teacher support and the connection between teacher support and the kind of curriculum that is examined, all of those bits of the puzzle are very disarticulated. So, and then you have a large private school sector, which, but yeah, I'd need to know how those who's in the sample frame, because the citizenship issue in a number of those oil-rich countries means that some people aren't citizens, but are getting very poor education because they're not. So they're complex contextual factors. I'm just tipping those into the mix from quite a superficial reading of their educational practices.
Please, we need to use the microphone. Yes, please, just wait for a minute.
Sorry, this is a bit anecdotal because I've had taught in the Middle East, and the public schooling is pretty poor.
And the private schools are...
Private schools do dominate, but I have to say, generally speaking, the non-native people living in the country have to go into private school. They can't because either they don't speak Arabic or for whatever reason.
Put your microphone nearer, like...
Sorry.
As in karaoke.
I didn't want too much feedback. Okay.
Thank you for the comment. I think we go for the next question over there.
He answered his own question. Which is
just a comment. Maybe we could say as a general rule that a certain degree of wealth is a necessary condition, but it's not a sufficient condition. Would you agree with that?
Yep. Yes.
Yeah, I guess one way that I kind of would like to kind of condense the topic and some of the debate is this importance of connecting what works with what matters. So they're kind of almost two streams in political and social research on education, and in some ways the shades of opinion across this panel are reflecting it. There's one set of views that's saying what matters is inequality, what matters is what happens in the what matters is a whole range of processes around values, what ought to be. And then there's a whole other nexus of research and activity, which is saying really what works is what we need to drive for, and what works costs money, finding out what works. And it's either money going to be generated through your tax system, or money's going to be generated through aid, or money's going to come from diaspora communities and remittances in different ways. So what works needs to be paid for. And I think the task, one of the tasks of an academic critical community such as this one, is to connect these things together. Because if it matters to you, we've got to make it work. If addressing inequality matters to us, we have to think how to make it work and what ways to generate the money to do it. So I suppose it's a plea for... thinking beyond the kind of the divisions of, money can't buy you everything. It sure helps a lot. It can buy you quite a lot, and we need to get more money to address some of the inequality issues in education.
Hanno.
Yes, one thing is that... one part of this educational religionism or educational faith is that education is a medical for everything. So, and this is a long tradition, especially in the US, but always in other countries too, that we think that it's a key for everything. And it would be a very nice key because, then you can move the blame to the individual. If you don't get education, it's your fault or something like that. But education alone is not able to solve the problem of inequality and inequity in the society. It's one part of it, but it's not all, of course. So you have to combine other political issues. Let me just give one example from Finland. The Finnish comprehensive school is well known about equality and the high level of quality at the same time. But if we leave the living areas to segregate, the education and pedagogics can't do anything. So we do have this housing policy is the key in this sense. You also could say that the employment policy is a key, and then education may work. So it's a part of the of the whole. I'm sorry to say that, of course, because it would be much more simple to believe that education would solve all the problems, but no.
Ritva.
I wanted to challenge, Elaine, you a little bit on this, that we need more money to deal with inequalities. In the particular case of South Africa, I mean, I'm giving that as an example, that money alone just doesn't seem to do it. You know, when you look at the public spending in many countries, and then you look at South Africa, when apartheid fell and the new majority government came to power in 1994, ever since there has been only revolution and then comes South Africa in terms of shifting the spending on poor people. The incidence analysis that are done on who gets that spending actually is really highly, highly poverty-oriented. And yet, the system has not been able to create good quality education. So to me, South Africa is the real stark example on that money alone. This is so much of the, as I said earlier, teachers usually when they come from their college, they are what I would call intrinsically motivated. They're not just motivated by the pay. They want to do good. They want to teach students. And then you ask, why is it that the system is such that all those, let's say, idealistic people, newly educated, end up in a system where they behave in such a way that there is very little learning in South African schools? So that was just, maybe generally, Elaine, your point is true, but money alone doesn't make it.
Mm. Yeah, and I think the dialogue really fleshes out probably some of these points we've been making about context and complexity. Because it's true there's a spend, but it's also true that 50% of children drop out of school. So they fail to, even though schooling is compulsory, the 50% fail to complete. And there are complicated issues around housing, around health, around the labor market, around lack of reproductive rights. It's a complicated story. And the spending hasn't been equal on all those areas.
And you confirm now Hannu's point beautifully.
I think I am. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Marit and Risto, do you want to add to this complexity?
Complexity, yes, and following what Hannu said and discussed this comprehensive education. In a way, when you think about the field of early childhood education and equality or inequality, very easily these Nordic countries, they are considered as the model countries in these services. They provide them for all children and like until next August all Finnish or our children will still have this subjective right for early childhood education for as many hours a day as the parents decide. Then it will change. But in a way, this idea about public services in our field, it hides, like in the Finnish context, the possibilities that there are actually, or at least potentially, for unequal services or provision of early childhood education, since we have, for example, municipal, fairly big municipal independence, how to organize these and how to support other types or other ways to take care of children. And also internationally, there are examples how, for example, emphasis on professionalization with other kind of societal aspects leads to decrease in the use of early childhood education, which is considered as quality service.
Yeah. Yes, Risto.
So in a way, this idea that we need to really study what I agree with Hannu, what happens when different developments, practices are implemented, what's happening in all of these steps from transnational to local and grassroots level.
Yes, Risto.
Well, as Hearn wrote in his book, Limits and Possibilities of Education, of course, we have to take it seriously that education is just one institution, very important institution, but it is not separated from society. It is a piece of society. It is making selections. It is putting people to the places. It is giving identities to people, and it is giving everything like a society demands. But because Hannu said that he is not the same opinion of me or something, so I'm not the same opinion of him, because I have to be. So I think that, of course, the housing politics is, of course, one thing, but it is not the housing politics. It is the whole social politics, the whole economic politics, the whole society, which is actually deciding what is happening and what kind of limits and possibilities each nation's schooling and education is having. And now I want to give one ask to my colleague here, because the World Bank is World Bank. And of course we can say that World Bank practices very, very social, economic funding of developing countries and so forth. But the fact is also that the World Bank, as you, are practicing ideological work to make the world look like one capitalistic organization as a whole. So as for example, Susan Robertson and Roger Dale has shown very clearly. So this question of mine is not right to this, but it is also the question of funding, money. I think that when you say that teachers are teaching only 2.5 hours or something like that, I believe that funding and money are very important concerning the developed countries. What is your opinion?
Would you like to answer?
Funding and money, like our colleague from Korea said, they are the necessary but not sufficient condition. I think that was well put. Okay, let me say this. It's really interesting, the World Bank, view of the World Bank is the one that used to be there when we were young. The World Bank is now led by a health activist, Jim Kim, and so forth. So it's a different place. But there is this myth that it has so much money and can have so much impact everywhere. What has really happened in the poor countries and some lower middle income countries as well, during the era of Millennium Development Goals and debt relief, because these countries were getting a lot of debt relief, there has been a push, and it has been partly coming from the World Bank, but mostly also from the countries. It is all these countries that spend so much of their own money. They do have tax money, even if so much tax evasion is happening, as we know from the Panama Papers. They do have own revenues, and they are spending a lot on education and health, between 20 to 40% of their budgets. Yes, the World Bank has money, and like I had a department, Human Development for Africa, my portfolio was about 10 billion. Okay, it sounds like a lot, but it's divided between 48 countries and so forth. It's just so little. Kenya did today. The whole aid is probably 1 or 2% of their budget. So it's increasingly limited. And that's great because nobody can develop anyone else. Countries develop themselves. And then, yes, you can be helpful when there are those who have the will and the drive and the desire to develop, then money works. But if you don't have it, there is no World Bank, no organization that can do that. And maybe to add last point is that it's really funny because there is often this this sense that the World Bank can dictate all that happens. That's just entirely not true. It is just a myth. But then when new people come to the picture, so like our new president comes to the picture as an advocate, he wants to use that. I want these countries to do this. It's completely different from the economist, but still try and use the force of money and say you get this money if you do this. No, countries don't develop that way at all. I talked with the South Korean participant among you there. South Korea is one of the most amazing development stories in the entire world, probably the fastest. They also put the kids to school fastest than ever anybody else. And it was, yes, very helpful. U.S. helped them. There was political economy, North Korea, South Korea, all that. But it depends on the country itself and the people itself. So I don't know whether I answered your question, but I tried.
Thank you. This leads to a question that one of the former directors also at the World Bank said, Joseph Stiglitz, he has said that, for instance, inequality is a choice. And if inequality is a choice, and inequality has been one of the issues that I think all of you have mentioned to some extent at least, and if we are to solve inequality, and if we apply Stiglitz's statement, he says it's a choice. Governments may make a choice. So that's also to remind us, how can we get good governance? We are an education institution here. We are university. We do conduct research, as we have heard here during these 2 days, and we do educate the future generation, maybe of experts, professionals, who knows? Some ministers have come from this university as well, mm-hmm. as we talked earlier. And so what can we do? What can research do? If we want to look at governance issues, and if we think like inequality is always a choice by somebody. That comes to politics, certainly, and social structures, including education. But how can we, as a research and education institution, contribute to maybe reducing inequality if we look at it from the governance point of view? And our main task is research, or tasks are research, education, and also social change. And we do, I think, agree all that inequality is an issue still today and an issue to be addressed still in the future.
It's so hard to be the first one politely being asked.
You don't have to. Marit looked like she would like to respond, but Elaine, you are welcome to start. Yes.
I think a very important aspect of what research can do is listen to people who suffer inequality. Because if we, one of the, the dynamics of, if you choose inequality, you're choosing not to listen, you're choosing not to see, and you're often choosing to blame the poor for being poor, for being uneducated, for being different. So that's something I like to pitch out, that research can be part of that bridge to hearing the effects of inequality. If we don't know the effects, we can't begin to address it. But, yeah.
Okay. Marit.
Okay. Mainly two things came to my mind. Not an easy question you asked, but in a way, inequality being a choice of the governance or government and yeah, but I think that if it's a choice or when it is a choice, it's however, it's not always what is kind of wanted or what is expected or what's the main kind of aim. The first response that came to my mind was dialogue. I agree with Elaine, of course. Kind of, we need to learn from the people, from those who are experiencing suffering or being in the position, in equal position. But we need to learn also about and study the dynamics and how, for example, inequality is produced when it's not the aim. But then I think that the dialogue with those who have the power or are in a more powerful position, the governments, the administration. And for example, in our project, it has been a kind of a surprise how eager both the actors at the national level and local level have been to collaborate with us, even though the topic is fairly, in a way, you can think that it's fairly sensitive also to think about the potential inequality that early childhood education is and these services are producing.
Who would like to continue? Yes.
Of course, Stiglitz and many other people are quite right. Inequality is a choice. In this world of ours, there's no God, there's no natural phenomenon we must obey. This is political things we are making. And of course it is a choice. And it is a choice which is making good for some people, some classes, and making not good to some classes, some other people. So I think this is quite natural. Of course this is a choice. It is a choice of education, but it is also a choice of whatsoever, about economic welfare or whatsoever, all around the world. And this means that in this new globalized world, with a free trade and everything like that, the only possibility for the humankind and us here, the people, is to make some kind of control system how much inequality we can stand. So I really mean... And in Europe, but also in the worldwide, we have to put some kind of stop in equalizing the world.
You mean a stop to inequalizing or equalizing? You said
inequalizing.
Yes, right, I heard correctly. Yes, and Ritva, you wanted to continue.
I thought earlier, Risto, when you were describing that education is just part of the bigger thing, to me the word is social contract. every society has a social contract, and then these various policies, education, housing, labor market, etc., are in a way elements of that social contract. But then I guess about the choice, to me, then the question is, who makes the choice? Whose choice is it? And yes, in a democratic, a democracy is not good, but there is nothing better. So there is a voice, etc. I have worked in many, many countries where the choice is Middle East, for instance, you mentioned, is really the privileged elite whose choice it is, and it's manifest that. So in that sense, I must say, coming back perhaps to Elaine's point, Elaine said one way of doing it is to listen to those who are at the bad end of that inequality. Fine, that's fine. The other one, Stiglitz is of course he's my former boss. He's a very prominent speaker and has a lot of influence. Another one that at least in some cadres, I don't know whether you have been influenced by it at all, is Thomas Piketty, who wrote the Amazon best-selling book, Capital in the 21st Century. And now that I no longer work at the World Bank, I left recently. I had time to read that book, and it is just massively powerful. I used to think that inequality studies are boring. After that book, I don't think at all that way. It is influenced with the Panama Papers. It is probably creating a shift with respect to inequality. So what is my point? My point is that, yes, listening the ground and the ones who suffer, but also you can have, because you need to influence some of these elites who are forcing their social contract on people. So sometimes this type of kind of top-down, if Piketty, if you want, is that kind of piece. And it's research. It's research having a huge impact. And anyway, it has 800 pages, and it's still selling the most. So it's quite something. So that, combined with the listening, can be quite important, because and then you are the ones who do political research. Isn't that a lot about power relations? Those are the ones that are really very important. And for an economist, they in a way dictate the economics, they dictate the education and so forth. So it's those power relationships in society. And I very much like what I've heard from colleagues is that how these things link together. You can't separate. I like it. Education is one part and there are many others.
Okay, Hannu.
Well, I'm more than happy to be optimist here and share the good news, I would say so. Because 10 years ago, you wouldn't speak like that if you would be working in World Bank. And it was before the Piketty's book.
The World Bank is irrelevant.
It was before the Piketty's book. And there has been a change. This is my opinion, my feeling, that the times, they are changing. It's about the 10 years ago when the neoliberal wave has got its highest position, and now it's a new time coming up. And there are a lot of evidence of that. And for example, International Money Foundation and its president Descartes, what is her name? Descartes or something like that. But she, for example, said that few years.
Oh, you mean International Monetary Fund. Christine Lagarde.
She said that there's no reason that half of the economy of the world is in the hands of the people who can get one double-decker in London. There's no reason for that. And she said that control, control, control. We need the control in education. Now they are trying to, move the line, change the line, and European Union is against that. And also in OECD is sending that there is too much inequality in some countries. And 10 years ago, they sent the letters saying that you have to privatize the education. Same thing with the World Bank, isn't that so? Yes. So there has been some clear changes in the world. I would be skeptically optimistic in this moment that the neoliberal wave is hard to say that it's gone, but there are some elements there. And you know all these Panama Papers and all this kind of... Piketty is intellectually very important, but it was Piketty, not Piketty, who made that. It was the world and all these crises we have in financial level. Yes, I agree that equality and especially inequality is a choice. It's a political choice, to put it simple.
I think, Hannu, you said quite right that you are optimist, I'm a pessimist, I would say skeptic. But I would say that look at Finland, what kind of things here are happening? And look at the world, where inequality is all the time going further and further.
We come in the list.
So I wouldn't say so.
We come in the last wagon, you know, always. It takes time here.
Yes, I think... What I would like to do is to invite some more questions. We have touched inequality. There's two questions over there. I'll bring over the microphone.
Thanks. I guess I'm Maikki from University of Helsinki. So I guess I'm not the only student here who is overexcited that we have a practitioner joining us for the event today. So. I'm utilizing this opportunity to pose a question to Dr. Reinikka. I found it interesting that you mentioned earlier about your own personal history, that you were skiing to school and found yourself to be this example of a person who's gone through the Finnish public education system. And this brought to my mind something that I have been hearing in some events from Martti Ahtisaari and Pekka Haavisto, they have discussed something along the lines of telling about Finnish civil war in some African countries that are torn apart by similar types of events. So, and on the other hand, in the development economics classes or development studies, we have learned about this concept of development that is based on the idea that development is not something where less developed countries are following the footpaths of more developed countries. So I'm not pretty sure what my question here is, but would be interesting to know about your own experience with World Bank, since that's probably an institution where many of us master's students are dreaming of working for. Mm-hmm. So have you been somehow able to influence people with your personal, national and educational background, or... Are there any experiences to be shared? What it's like working in international development as a Finn?
I think to pick up you had a good commentary anyway, and there was a question as well. To pick up your last thing, and I think it fits really this theme. I don't think I have been. Yes, it's good to be. Coming from a small country, which is non-threatening. When I was country director in South Africa for the World Bank, I think they didn't like the World Bank at all. And the only positive that I had was the fact that I was a Finn, because Finland had supported ANC about 40 years, and so that was a good. But I do think when I was able to influence was because I had research evidence to back it up, not from Finland, but in the country that I was dealing with. So I am very much with Hannu, whom I met here for the first time. That's why I was saying I'm his friend, because I think it's you need to know what the reality is. And once you know that, of course, you don't have a perfect reality. You have you are making every effort to understand what's going on. But I think that has been a possibility to influence. And perhaps the other thing in when working in a multi-sectoral organization, usually you have to try and influence the finance minister, and that they are tough customers. So you may think your thing is very good, but you know there are many competing priorities. So I really all those 20 years research really served well. Influencing, because you want to influence, you want to these countries to do better, etc., to the best of your ability. So I think And I'm very glad to hear that young people are dreaming of working in the World Bank. So it means that it's your questions, Risto Sama, old fashioned, as I am an old woman. So it is. Let me say this: it is fantastic to work in a place where you feel you make a difference. It is just, and another thing, I guess I always loved working there because there were so many smart people. So you are not sinking into a muddle of like all kinds of, murky things. You are always lifted up by your colleagues because they come from other. I was a director of a department and I had 75 nationalities. 200 people in my department, 75 nationalities. It teaches you also, you have to be rather humble, because people come from very, very different things. So those are fantastic things, to be able to change things and improve things and then have just great colleagues from all over the world. So that's a good, very, very good environment.
But you have to include into your studies economics, numbers, statistics, and all kind of ugly things for humanists. Please do that and go to the World Bank.
He's right. Hannu is correct.
Wow.
Yeah, but political economics.
But there is a
question. Okay. I'm Anna-Maria from the University of Helsinki, and I have a more of a fundamental question regarding decision-making in education. I'm not sure if you will be willing to answer the question, but I'll pose it anyway. So in this conference and elsewhere during the master's studies, we've been discussing the problems of global governance in education, but also problems of national governance in terms of that the education might become a nation-building machine. There are also similar problems probably found on the local level. And I guess, so the fundamental question I wanted to pose is that at what level, speaking from your own experience and backgrounds where you're coming from, at what level do you think it should be decided what is taught in schools and how?
I think these questions can only make sense at the national level. So the detail, the texture, those are national decisions and they are local decisions. And even down below the level of local government, maybe they are sometimes even school decisions. But I think the sorts of points I was trying to express yesterday were that some of those aspirational steers around equality, around rights, around gender equality, addressing forms of exclusion. Sometimes it's impossible to formulate those in national countries. You know, I grew up in apartheid South Africa, high levels of censorship, a whole leadership generation was locked up in prison, nobody would speak the name of Mandela. But sometimes it's very hard to formulate and articulate the question of equality. The kind of discussion we've been having today is not possible in some universities, and sometimes even naming issues like the power of colonization, the power, so articulating decolonization as a really important aspect of curriculum. Sometimes, so that there are, it's important to be close and outside, and you need those views from both perspectives. I know it sounds like a fudge, but I think it's a fudge that we actually need to keep both those things in play.
I'm going to change your question. So what needs to be taught in early childhood education and how? Basically nothing.
if we think about teaching in a traditional way. But more seriously said, in this field, I think we need some kind of core plan curriculum at the national level. But I would say that we need something that is not individual-oriented, not oriented to the skills of the individual as we have, for example, in the UK, but which is like more about or defines goals for the institution and its practices. But then when we talk about very young children, then we also, there's the need for local and like family knowledge, and of course the children's kind of knowledge about the children as individuals. So not more about this issue, if you don't have any specific questions related to that.
Well, I don't perhaps change the question, or when I do, I'm not sure. But anyhow, first of all, I would say that governance in this whole world is escaping from national governments. It is escaping to global firms, to global supranational organizations like World Bank, and it is escaping to local levels after the decentralization, deregulation of everything in Finland, for example, and everywhere in European Union, for example. So the national decision-making in every field, not only educational politics, but every field, is diminishing, and its importance is going down. And that's why I would say that the kind of core curriculum or whatsoever we want to make, our national government is doing the choices and decisions which are demanded by the World Bank, the OECD, the European Union, and all over the unofficial atmosphere of a global, I would say, firms, first of all, and then also different kinds of things there. So I think that the nation state of Finland is a victim of all these things, and also our educational system at this moment is going down like in an elevator. This was not the answer to you, but it was for me.
We have one more question over there, Paul.
Oh, okay, just a brief comment about what some of the answers you gave. This 1948 UN document called the Universal Rights on the Universal Declaration on Human Rights, Article 26, Clause 3 says that every parent has a prior right to decide on the kind of education that their children shall receive. I think that's almost a direct quote. So I don't see any of you talking about parental rights and determining the kinds of education their children should receive. And it seems to reflect a kind of general movement of attitude, a kind of change of attitude over the decades. Maybe I'm too old-fashioned, but I think that parents have an important say in how their children, what kind of things they should learn at school. And unfortunately, I think there are many situations where parents have almost no voice anymore in the kinds of things that the children learn. And I think parents are, and families, as a result, are being disenfranchised by the education system. And maybe this poor performance in education is reflective of this kind of level of disenfranchisement of parents and families. My question now is pertaining to how language is being used to promote policies that in effect create more inequalities, but they're actually supposedly meant to reduce these inequalities. For example, in America we have educational act called No Child Left Behind. Now, of course, when you look at it, it seems to be that they're promoting more equality, right? But if you look at this 1,000-page plus document, if anyone has the time to do that, there are certain sections where it seems to be targeting certain people with lower income people. For instance, it says that every child in the public school system must all the contact details of every child must be submitted to the Pentagon. Now there are some people at Harvard, for instance, lecturers, they say this is probably due to the fact that the military is not recruiting as many blacks and Hispanics as they were before, and they're trying to compensate for this by having all these details. And now, from anecdotal stories that I hear, the military recruiters are extremely aggressive in recruiting these public school students, especially in the urban areas. So it seems that this rhetoric, I think Professor Unterhalter mentioned this yesterday, how rhetoric is being used in a certain way that's rather deceptive. Could you comment on this further?
Could we ask Ritva to start, and then I think Elaine and Marit? Yes.
I wanted to say that it's really good that you brought up the parents' role. It's really, really important. And I think in the context where I have worked, the choice parents have had is private school. And it's not the elite private school I'm talking about. There are so many $2 per semester private schools in the poorest places. So in a way, that has been some choice. But you highlight the issue that as an economist, the way we articulate this is it that there are like multiple principles and one agent. So there are the parents, there is the politicians who want nation build, there are the entrepreneurs who want workforce, etc. So it's a really multi-principle kind of system, and parents are really surely a very important thing. It's good, and I agree. One of my experiences that has influenced me a lot, I was co-director for World Development Report, which is called Making Services Work for Poor People. It's about 10 years old, but it's still valid. So we had a triangle where we said services work when the relationships of accountability between people, be it parents, customers, patients, whatever, politicians, and the providers, when that triangle works, that's when things work. And that has definitely parents as an important factor. I think your second points were so wild that I have no idea what Pentagon is doing. But I wanted to mention that No Child Left Behind is no longer there because Obama's administration introduced a new policy like a few months ago, maybe end of last year, and tried to address some of the issues you just mentioned that were.
Sorry, we can't hear you, and we are also recording.
But No Child Left Behind is no longer there. But I'm sure it's like in any policy that had some aspirations, etc. Then it goes on, and you see the side effects. And anyway, you have a different regime. It took Obama administration for a long time to come up with the new policy, but they have. So that's all on that.
I guess I want to address the question about parents and families down two tracks. I think it's important to see the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and not separate it from all the other instruments around rights, the Convention of the Rights of the Child, the Economic and Social Rights, the instruments on economic and social rights. And particularly, I wanted to connect it with the Beijing Platform for Action, because often under that notion of parents, we're not, and families, we're not thinking about the gender dynamics that are sometimes there in families. So I think one of the achievements of this global governance framework of the last 30 or 40 years, and there's much that can be criticized about it as being top-down, decontextualized, associated with elites, many, many criticisms of it. But one of the achievements has been to put in these kind of other layers to see rights as contextual and to see them as needing to be built up in a number of ways. So yes, the rights of parents, as articulated in 1948, were, you know, one has to see that in the context of the aftermath of the Second World War and the very the ways in which education systems had been used to promote fascism and very arrogant forms of nationalism, and I think that continues to be the case. But I don't think we can separate the rights of parents and say we'll only stand up for the rights of parents. It's the kind of broad base of connected rights that's, I think, been an achievement of the negotiations over the last 30 or so years.
Okay. Yes, thank you for this question. These parents' rights, parents' participation in education, I think if you start to really look at educational literature, that's something that has been discussed a lot, and it has increased the attention to the parents' participation did increase a lot during the 20th century. And nowadays, If you search for papers and use partnership as your search term, you'll find a lot of literature on this. But what is interesting is that often then the discussion is about ethnic minorities, children needing special education or social or families or children living in adversity and so on. So it's used in a specific context.
I would say that at the grassroots level, the institutions, school, early childhood education, for example, they are more and more trying to involve parents, but the institutional kind of limits are also quite strict. So, for example, in our legislation, we now have this requirement that parents have to be involved or have the right to be involved in planning the curriculum of an EC institution, this institution, and at the local level, but it will be a really, or at least partly, a tough job to make it happen. But this parental rights, and then the rights of the child. We also know from research, especially from social work and those fields, that
that they can be kind of contradictory, or there's a tension between them. So if we highlight the children's rights, then what in difficult situations, what is the, how do we think about the parents' rights, or what is the kind of the equilibrium between them? But then these parents' rights, rights to decide, or parental choice, and so on, this rhetoric can be really deceptive too. I would say that in our system, but I don't start lecturing, but this is something we have in early childhood education, or in early years, we talk about parental choice, but if we start to look at the politics, the choice is not everywhere and not for all. Okay.
Yes, Risto.
Just very shortly, because the time is going out. First of all, we've Hannu made a five-year very wide research on educational choices, and interviewed and also research by surveys parents' choices in Finnish primary or comprehensive school system. So we have a lot of knowledge what actually is happening in Finland. But I would say to you, I agree with the United Nations decision on children's rights and these kind of things. But you know that Nordic countries have built their educational system latest from the Second World War, but also before, on the principle of almost monopoly of state guidance in primary school and secondary school. And the meaning has been to make better and better educational equality policy, not only in school, but also in society. And at the moment, this tide of neoliberal politics, including a lot of things, but including also the parental choice, has come to Finland. But happily enough, I would say, we have only taken some parts of it. So we are talking with Hannu about the segmenting of comprehensive school by parents' and families' social background, educational level, and many kinds of these kinds of things, classes. Our comprehensive school is not based on classes before, but at the day we are going to that direction, and I'm very worried about that. But still, Finland is the exception with all the countries about that we have not gone very far in that direction. But the time is out. Thank you.
Thank you for the comments. Yes, you're right, the time is out, and what I would like to have a very brief, short message that you would like us, the participants, to take home with us. Can you be, please, very brief?
Can someone else start?
Yes, we can. Hannu can start now.
What
yes.
did you say? Message?
The short message you would like to give us before we end this plenary.
My message would be realist utopies. Realist utopies. So we need utopies, but they should be realist, and they can be realist only if we know the situation. I just comment this question of parents' rights, that education as such is not only a good thing, it's a contradictory thing. It depends how it is and where it is implied. In our country, it was just recently, in 50s, in 60s, I think that very many Finns thought education as a military service, not as a stairway to heaven. So it depends. So, realist utopies.
Wherever I have worked and whenever I meet parents and regular people in the countries that I have worked, all parents want their kids to have good education. There is no such poor person who wouldn't want it. It is really universal. So my key message is that now that you become, go into your professions, and like in this morning's seminar, I heard so many people, what can I do? I want to, at various level, very local, medium, national, international level, have an impact. So if you, in, I think in the quality of learning is the biggest impact, and particularly the poorer countries. I think that is really what drives me and the work I do now. And I want to finish by why we already quoted learning for all, but Elina, I want to say, and all for learning, meaning we all need to work for that learning, because it is not obvious. The context in many other places is very, very different from this country. So it really is learning for all and all for learning.
I will have a very short comment, because I'm very strict to research and myself. I would say that I would make no recommendations to no one. The duty of a researcher is to research and make the things to be visible behind the ideology which they are naamioitu. All right, but anyhow, I don't want to make policy when I'm researching. I make policy in different areas.
Okay, you mixed my thoughts. I almost have to change what I said, but thought I said. But I say the first thing anyhow. I would say that learn about concepts and learn about discourses and think about them. For example, we briefly talked or kind of exchanged ideas about early childhood education. Actually, what is early childhood education in different discussions? Or we talk about inequality. What did we have actually in mind when we talked about inequality?
Yeah.
So think about these like self-evident terms and words and discourses we use.
And I would just add mix things up, borrow lots of ideas and bridge top down, bottom up, all the way across the middle. Think about the context and try to make some real life utopias, because they, you know, we've heard examples of people doing it, and you can too.
Thank you very much, all, for your important messages and a very interesting dialogue we had here today. Thank you for the discussions and also for the questions. And what I would like to do is to invite our dean, Professor Marja-Leena Laakso, and Professor Hannu Simola, I almost said Heikki Simola, Hannu Simola, to close this session for today. What I would like to say before we totally end is that I sometimes feel here at my work, as you said about the World Bank, we have so many nationalities and so many enthusiastic people, and you know, all you know, aiming high for sure.
Yeah, that's great.
Ladies and gentlemen, it's my very honor to have been present in this two-day seminar. And I think Marit said just that her ideas were mixed with the word she just heard. And I think that my head is very, very confused about hearing this very, very interesting panel. First of all, I think that the themes that this 2 days event had, I think, kind of two themes. The one, the changing environments of learning, and the other one, thinking about the relevance of political and sociology of education, are extremely important. And I can't imagine any more topical issues for this kind of meeting. And I'm very happy for the, I don't know who invited the idea of joining these two, those two ladies there, that it was a very, very great idea. If you, Hannu, allow me to say some words, and I would like to then hear something from you also. So now I think I'm speaking as a dean of the Faculty of Education, and if I think the issues around us, one is, of course, which it has been mentioned many times during these days, that the world is changing extremely fast rate, and the crisis we are facing in various parts of the world are extremely influencing our society and whole Europe and globally. Another thing that in the university level or faculty level, I think that the internalization is a very, very, very big issue. And we are in a happy position here in Jyväskylä that we are, as I have understood, we have the amount of exchange students is the biggest in our country. And we have two very successful international master programs. So as Elina said, we are becoming more and more international here in our faculty. One that we are truly missing is that we don't have very many scholars in our faculty, international scholars, professors, teachers, which I hope is going to change also. And then the third issue, I think that there's all the time growing issue in international cooperation or education export field. At the moment, just we heard this week that Vietnam is wanting to have a Finnish school. We already have Finnish school in Qatar. Head of the teacher education department is traveling in this weekend to Colombia. I was last week in Brazil. There's very much interest in Finnish education and cooperating in this field. And the last thing that I'm thinking, in our university we are making structural reforms in the faculty structures, and during that process there was an idea that the Faculty of Social Sciences will be joined together with the Faculty of Education, and I think that all our faculty staff were very, very, very interested in the fact that we would be in the same faculty with the sociology, social policy, political science, these disciplines, and also psychology. And the result from these reforms were that we are joining together with psychology, but the social sciences didn't want to come with to be in the same faculty. And I was heard many times that they were saying that nobody there is studying the issues of education or schooling or things like that that are our priorities. And it's very hard to kind of believe that. And now I'm thinking that you have had this great master's program for sociology and politics of education, and when you're thinking all these issues, the crisis, the education export, the facts facing us, why is this program ending, or what is coming instead?
Yeah, I think that many people think that why I'm talking again, because I was there in the panel and I was talking enough, I think. But if I understood correctly, this is the reason why I was with Risto, we started this program actually in 2002. So they are quite long processes, these kind of things. And we had in this master program, we had four 2-year courses. And I'm more than happy to be here and find this panel and all these presentations here, and also your presentation, dear dean of the faculty here. I share this idea of importance of the sociological and political studies in education, but as you said, the fact is that it's not very high in quantitative sense in this country. We have a few centers concentrating to that. But still, I'm sure that this is a funeral in the New Orleans way when we start playing happy jazz after that, so there is no reason to cry. I'm sure that there will be a future in this kind of studies in this world. And because I think that there is a real social need of this kind of understanding, not only in the export of education, but also in all this, as I said, 150 years of frustration of educational reforms. It might be enough. So, and we do have the so-called digitalization process going on now. It definitely will give new possibilities, but how they are, we can't know that in advance. So we need research for that. And so I am skeptical optimist here too, so that we will have a future. So don't cry anymore. So just marching on. So thank you very much for being here, and thank you very much for giving me the opportunity to speak in this panel and everybody here. Thank you.
So I think it was a better idea that we had you here closing than Risto, because you, as also I am, we are optimistic people, so we have a kind of more optimistic view. I had in mind that I would like to ask the audience, because I said that I'm confused, and as a dean, I would like to know what is all the things that we need to do now, and I hoped I could ask you, what is your take-home messages, if I can learn something from them, what we should do in the Faculty of Education to support these ideas and face these challenges that the field is having. If somebody would like to say something, so I take it as my take-home message from you.
Something happy.
And optimistic, hopefully.
Well, just to start, I want to point out that I'm an outsider. I come from the field of communications. But after attending to this colloquium, I've come to realize that a model of education is also a model of society. And in that sense, whoever is making the educational policies or whoever is studying to become a teacher has to always keep in mind what is the wider framework, what is education actually meant for. And it's not only, you know, getting kids to be able to respond some certain standardized tests, but also, you know, to use all the tools in hand to make a better or at least not so bad society. So that's what I'm taking for the seminar.
Thank you. Very beautiful idea.
Thanks.
And there were other hands also wanting to advise us. Over there.
I think you still hear it. So I will keep it like this. So basically one of the things is that if you think about practices, because I have background in natural sciences, social sciences, and now educational sciences, because I wanted to bridge the fields. And how it happens quite easily is traineeships and also the final works, thesis works of students. I work with natural science students with whom we think how to bridge a couple of other faculties. So that will be my kind of take-home advice, that think about the collaborations, what you already have, and innovative, out-of-the-box thinking a bit, what could be in the future by starting thinking about what students already do and they need to do in order to graduate. And then perhaps you could convince also the social scientist to see what is the value of cooperation perhaps even then on a faculty level in the future.
Yeah, and you are definitely right that the faculty shouldn't be any kind of boundaries for cooperation and doing things together. And the new curriculum reform that is going on in our university, it says that we have to build more these kind of multidisciplinary courses and projects. So we are definitely going in that direction. Thank you.